Welcome, this is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com and of course SpoilingFrogsPost.com, and today is the 2nd of December 2011 here in Japan. It's still the 1st of December 2011 back in the United States, where I'm joined on the line by none other than Sibel Edmonds, the founder of BoilingFrogsPost.com. So Sibel, it's great to have you on the program again. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, James.
All right, well, I wanted to talk today about a very fascinating article that you recently posted up on BoilingFrogsPost.com under the headline U.S.-NATO-Chechen Militia Joint Operations Base, that paints a very interesting picture of something that, as you note in the article, is really unreported, completely unreported in the mainstream American media, which is the U.S., NATO, and Turkish links to Chechen militia rebels and terrorists, of course, acting against Russian interests. A very, very interesting topic that is well documented in the foreign press, but completely absent in American mainstream media. So perhaps you can tell us about some of the points in that article and some of the very interesting connections between these Chechen militias and Turkey, for example.
Right. Lately, in the past few months, here and there pops up some really superficial reporting on various assassinations of Chechen leaders taking place in Turkey, of all the places. And by Chechen leaders, these are the militant leaders of the Chechen groups who've been fighting and carrying out various operations and terrorist-related operations in Russia and elsewhere. And so they are not just, you know, Chechen political leaders, but they are also militants. And they have established their base in Turkey. And again, this is not recent. This has been going on for almost two decades. And Russia, I guess, has had enough. So they have started carrying out their own operations, covert operations, going to Turkey and one by one taking out these leaders. Because, well, they have a reason. They're saying this is self-defense. Chechens have been saying, well, this is for our own autonomy. But when you look at the mainstream media in the United States, that's the reporting. And usually the flavor that goes with it is, oh, well, here it is. They want their independence. And these are the Chechens that are fighting against, you know, Russians' hegemony, et cetera, et cetera. There is no mentioning of the context of what has been happening or what kind of terrorism related incidents that have been created by these groups and why they are in Turkey in the first place. You would think, why these Chechens, these leaders, why are they in Turkey? Why Russia is sending these operatives to Turkey to carry out these assassinations? Well, it's been missing from the media and the United States media, the mainstream media here, for two decades and for various reasons, important reasons, because the connections there is not only to Turkey of these Chechen militants. The connection is with NATO and specifically with the United States, and has been for about 15, 16 years. So that's why I wrote that article and I started listing some of these connections and some of these dots that are actually intentionally not being connected by the media here in the United States.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think because of that, this topic probably comes out of the blue for a lot of the people out there who just haven't been exposed to any of this information before. But as you allude to, this is something that's been going on for an awfully long time now, decades, really, this connection. So perhaps you can tell us a little bit about the history of the connection between Turkey and between the U.S. and the interests that they have in the region.
Sure. Well, what happened in 1990, 1991, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, is we, the United States, we said, okay, here is this great region of the greatest resources here. We are talking about oil, gas, all the natural resources. And what we want is the West. We want to get close to these nations in these regions, Central Asia and Caucasus, and basically grab the control of those resources. And that's known by everyone. Well, what did they do? How did they go about this? That is what that is not ever being talked about in the United States and is hush-hushed by the mainstream media. And despite the fact that, yes, they do receive reports either from various sources from the intelligence community or even documented, as you said, some of these incidents and these operations have been documented for years in other countries' media, in Europe, in Middle East, in Russia. So Chechens played a big role in these operations. And as far as managing these operations for the United States, with the United States, with these Chechens in that region against Russia, Turkey was the key country. So they, and this is NATO and the United States, through Turkey, they started establishing presence in that region. And as part of that operation, establishing this control, they started training and bringing bases in Turkey for the Chechen militants to get them create fairly sophisticated. In some cases, you will hear about suicide terrorism missions, but in some other cases, it's not. It goes further than that. And again, this started in early 1990s. And actually, in order to understand this, we have to take a few steps back from there. And that is the operation that was under NATO, and this is during the entire Cold War period, called Gladio. And I liken Gladio to CIA of NATO. And they did exactly the similar things that the CIA has been doing and is doing here under the United States government. And again, part of these CIA Gladio was directly and is directly, and I'm going to explain in a minute when I say is, to the CIA. And these operations that they carried out, and this was during the Cold War, it was all over Europe, in Eastern Europe, you know, the creating terrorism, aggravating people, causing a lot of incidents, and basically destabilized this entire region. Well, after the Cold War, even though they said, and this is NATO later, they admitted that, yes, we had this Gladio and we did carry out these operations, they did not dismantle. They kept one branch of Gladio open, and that was the branch that worked closely with Turkey, a NATO member, targeting Central Asia and Caucasus and the Balkans. And again, the same actors you had on the top, you have United States, NATO, then the mid-level operatives under them being these Turkish commandos that used to directly work for and with Gladio. And under that, you had various religious faction extremists, Chechens in this region that ended up, you know, we ended up forging partnerships, started training them, we started basically using them for our operations in that entire region. And again, the enemy being Russia. So that did not stop with the end of the NATO. So that stayed there. But then what happened was a big scandalous expose took place in Turkey called Susurluk incident. And this was around 1996, 1997. And the operation, because of it, this Gladio's arm of NATO's operation with Turkey in this region ended up being exposed, and the actors, the Turkish commandos involved. Once that took place, the United States basically deserted that Gladio branch of Turkey, and they said, we are going to go to Plan B. And Plan B was using religion, not the Gladio commandos in Turkey, under nationalism, to control and train and carry out our operations in this region. And these are black operations. And when I was working for the FBI, 1996 till 2001 contained my major work with the FBI was with this area, the area that involved these operations being carried out jointly by NATO, United States, the Turkish, a covert branch of Turkish military, and also these various religious pockets. Bin Laden's group back then, they didn't really refer to them as Al-Qaeda. The Mujahideens, they were part of that. The Chechens were part of these operations. They were at least half a dozen pockets of these groups, these religious extremists or independence-seeking groups that were working together with Turkey, U.S., and NATO, carrying out terror operations in that part of the world, in Central Asia and Caucasus.
As I understand it, one of the key figures in that Plan B, as you term it, of the post-Gladio destabilization campaign that's founded on the rise of this Islamic radicalism, was a figure by the name of Fethullah Gulen, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, so I hope you'll correct me. But at any rate, I understand that's one of the key figures in this whole nexus, so perhaps you can tell us a little bit more about who he is and how he's been connected to the foreign intelligence apparatus of the United States.
Sure. Fethullah Gulen, he was a Turkish imam in Turkey. Okay, since 80s, he was preaching, advocating for Islamic government for Turkey, and not the secular government that Turkey has had. The things had changed since Atatürk's time. And because of the secular stand of Turkish government, by mid-1990s, he ended up in Turkish government's wanted list. And he was about to go to jail because he wanted to overthrow the military regime, the military government in Turkey, and replace it with the Islamic one. Now, during the same time period, this Susurluk incident took place. And as I said, the cover was exposed for the United States, NATO, and these commandos. And the United States, they said, okay, we're going to go to Plan B, and that is via religion. And we have picked our person. It's going to be this guy, Fethullah Gulen. So the guy who was indicted was going to jail, mysteriously ended up in NATO-owned plane, private plane, and in 1997 came to the United States, landed here in Washington, D.C., and started working with the State Department, the CIA, and Pentagon in taking over where they stopped the plans with the Gladio arm, the Turkish commandos there who were the ultranationalist Turks. So what happened was Fethullah Gulen, within 3 years after he came to the United States, opened more than 300 mosques in Kyrgyzstan, in Azerbaijan, you just name all the stands that Pepe Escobar refers to as the stands. And they also, this is Fethullah Gulen as the leader of this religious, is actually considered a cult, the Islamic religious cult, madrasas, these school systems in all over Central Asia and Caucasus that they said, well, we're going to teach them science. This is a moderate Islam. We are not teaching them anything about fanaticism. So, in fact, we have science classes and we have even English classes. Well, what he did, Fethullah Gulen, was provided these cover jobs for all these CIA operatives to go to those regions. They all went there as volunteer English teachers because Fethullah Gulen's madrasas also taught English. And so you had hundreds of, and this is again documented. This was given to the mainstream media here in 2002, 2003 through my case, in your documentations. And they were given actually diplomatic passports. I mean, you're going to teach English as volunteers in Kyrgyzstan or Turkmenistan. Why are you carrying diplomatic passports? Of course, they didn't say they were CIA. They were using various NGOs, U.S. NGOs, that were volunteering their services to Fethullah Gulen's madrasas in that region. And in 1998, 1999, this was funded with drug money, heroin. It was funded through Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden family, they funded a major part of this, especially with the operations with Chechnya and also with Azerbaijan. Zawahiri was going and working with these mosques and madrasas. He went and attended several meetings there. So FBI files 1996 to 2001 dealt with a lot of these cases, which later became my state secrets privilege case. And all along from the beginning, I kept talking about this is mainly about Central Asia. It's about the Balkans. It's about how we've been carrying out terrorism, terrorism-related activities, and using various groups, and Bin Laden's group was included. They never referred to it as an Al-Qaeda. It was Mujahideen, our Mujahideen friends. A lot of these people were given Turkish passports. I mean, these were not forged. These were Turkish passports given to them. And once they got their Turkish passports from Turkey, NATO planes were taking these people during the wars in the Balkan area, you know, with Kosovo, to Eastern Europe, and they were actually there in the Balkans. Then they would go back. I mean, we as the United States and also NATO has been working with or had been working with Bin Laden and at least 6-7 other groups, including the Chechens in that region all the way until 2001, 9/11. And how would FBI come across this information? Again, that's another thing people don't understand about monitoring counterintelligence related communication. Let's say the FBI counterintelligence operation is targeting the Turkish-speaking entities here in the United States, whether they are the diplomatic community or the various lobby groups, NGOs, etc. Well, when you're monitoring them, this pipe that brings all this communication to you, to the translators, language specialists, and later goes to the analysts, it brings all communication, whether they are in Turkish or in other languages. For example, if Pentagon's people, they're calling the Turkish diplomatic entity here, they're going to be talking English. So you will be listening to Paul Wolfowitz carrying conversation, let's say, I cannot say specifically, let's say Turkish ambassador discussing various plans. You would have certain people within the State Department or CIA communicating with the military attaché for that country. And you, as a language specialist with these files, with these recorded stuff, you get to hear because it's not being separated, this communication in the pipes. They all come to you. And you start marking them. You know, this is in English, goes to this, and it's related to this. This is in Turkish or in other languages, and here is the importance, or this is extremely important, here is the verbatim. So what I'm saying is these files, FBI had these files, and FBI was very well aware of some of the criminal activities that were also being carried out here in the United States. This guy, Fethullah Gulen, came to the United States. In less than 10 years, he now worth more than $20 billion. And you can go and check it in Wikipedia, in the United States. His entire organization is set up in the United States. Why? He now owns the largest U.S. charter schools chain in the United States. And now he has more than 700 mosques and madrasas in Central Asia, in Caucasus, in the Balkans, and even some places in Indonesia. And all you would see is like glorifying language used by the mainstream media, talking about how he's teaching moderate Islam and how great he is. And if you look at the amount of money he's giving to various congressional people and the Senate, they all go to his events. And I'm talking about U.S. senators, U.S. congresswomen and U.S. congressmen. And they actually bent over before this guy. And you would say, what? Who is this guy? His education in Turkey was fourth grade. He left school fourth grade. He doesn't speak any English. He doesn't speak any foreign language. He doesn't have any degrees. He had never done business in his life. And this guy has $20 billion worth of an NGO. Well, the importance of Fethullah Gulen here is, number one, he's still active because he is the leader for the Central Asia and Caucasus movement, Islamic movement that U.S. still is trying to use to take over the important strategic nations over there. But not only that, even if we had stopped that after 9/11, hypothetically speaking, he knows so much. He and his people, if they were to open their mouth, if they were to leak what they had done, especially during those critical years, 1996 till 2001, with Bin Laden, this is not something that the United States would want, of course, to come out. And as I said, he's just a symbolic figure And they have been using him and his network and his groups and his madrasas and his mosques in that region. And again, back to that article, Chechen operations that have been, and again, I have said this during several interviews, by hinting, by actually saying it, and nobody seems to really pick up on the importance of this. When I say firsthand information that we had, I got to see, I got to read, I got to listen to, 1996 to 2001, every single terror operation that was carried out by Chechens in Russia and elsewhere in that region were financed, sponsored, trained, supported, protected by us. Not indirectly, directly. And now we are seeing that Russia says, well, enough is enough. You know, we are going to do what we're going to do. And in fact, they have been using the same justification as United States. But you know what? You're fighting terror. We are fighting our own terror. These are our terrorists. This is our kind of 9/11 Al-Qaeda. We're going to get them, whether they are in Turkey or whether they are in Dubai. And it's very interesting. If you look at these leadership for the Chechen terrorists, or even some of the other Islamic groups there that we have been working with, the number one country is Turkey. Number two country is Germany. Okay, you have the two top NATO allies. Then you have Dubai and you have Qatar. For some reasons, these people, these so-called terrorists, these Islamist terrorists, they don't end up in Iran or Syria. They never went to Libya or even Afghanistan. They are in Turkey, Germany, and Qatar and Dubai.
Extremely interesting. And I think the old investigative dictum to follow the money applies here as well as anywhere else. And on that note, of course, the Russians themselves have been doing their own investigative work on this line of reasoning. And as you point out in the article, they have connected financing for the Chechen militias to a construction company out of Turkey called Inka. And what can you tell us about this company and the financing for these Chechen militants?
Sure. Well, that information came out a while back. And combined with the information that had been public in my case and been given to all the top mainstream media, and this was when I was naive in 2002, 2003, you would have thought, okay, this would have been picked. Well, one of the things that came out on my case, and these were confirmed by congressional sources, other witnesses from Department of Justice, Vanity Fair reported on this, was one of the top organizations that was under investigation by the FBI was the American Turkish Council. It's a huge Turkish-American business group, and it's a Turkish lobby group, the biggest. I mean, people say after the Israel lobby, it's the second biggest lobby in terms of power. You look at their members, you see Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, you see Boeing. And their current chairman is, what's his name? when you look at all the chairmen, it used to be Brent Scowcroft. And now Richard Armitage he is the new chairman for American Turkish Council. So this came out in 2004, 2005 on my case. And the Russian documentary and investigation exposed one of the, and this is one of the many, financial operations to back these terrorists. And as I said, Chechens are only one. There are others. There are other Islamic groups there that we have been supporting. Was through this gigantic Turkish company called Enka and their construction company. And well, if you look at Enka is the top tier player and has been with the American Turkish Council here in the United States. And Enka, this Turkish construction company, of course, has presence all over Central Asia and Caucasus. And it's a very easy way for Enka to get the money to these various factions, again, whether it's Chechens or other groups. So if you go to Enka's website and look at the projects they have been working, you see that they build most of the, many of the, and renovate American consulates and embassies all over the world, in Africa, in Europe. say, that's interesting. The United States is using this Turkish construction company, not a U.S. construction company, or not several. It's just they're using mainly this company to do all sorts of renovation projects all over the world, like in Congo, in Africa. Why would be the case? Again, it is not difficult to realize what is happening here. And I got to see several cases like ENCA's, and ENCA was included in my the investigations that I was working with the FBI agents. What they do is, and this is United States, they have the bidding process. They make it a no-bid process in terms of being closed bid, not open. And they have ENCA to come and bid, let's say, for a project that would cost $1 million. They would bid $10 million, okay? And the State Department would say, okay, we want ENCA. You know, we want this construction company to build and or perform this particular renovation project. Of course, State Department, they have to submit this to Congress for approval. And they always rubber stamp it in Congress. So there you have ENCA has the $1 million that they would have gotten. They take the $9 million and they are told who to give it to, how to give it to. See, these black budgets, there are several ways, okay? Heroin is one way that with drugs we raise, and this is the CIA, our government does. Arms deal is one way. And then there's another one that is not exactly black, meaning, yes, it goes through congressional approval, all these contracts going to these Turkish companies to build various, you know, projects or buildings or services that they provide to United States government all over the world, whether it's in Saudi Arabia or Dubai. But it is arranged so they would bid an amount that is sometimes 100 times greater than what it should be. There is no inspection. And the deal is there. ENCA, many other Turkish companies like ENCA's, they pocket their share, and the rest, the U.S. says, you're going to give this Chechen group this, and you're going. The same thing. Another thing that we do is we use Turkey and we use the rerouting of the weapons we ship there. You know, Turkey is a NATO ally and they get billions of dollars worth of weapons shipped to them every year from the United States. Well, some of these orders, they go into the Turkish military, but per instruction, some of these shipments of these weapons, they are not meant for Turkey, and Turkey knows. Like, okay, this is going to go across the border into Georgia, and this is going to actually go to Dubai. And from Dubai, somebody else is going to take over and carry it to country XYZ. So again, ENCA and these Turkish companies, Turkey's role as the recipient of these weapons when the agreement behind the scene is you get this and then the rest of it is going to go to these various terrorist factions. Turkey plays a very, very important role. And that was, again, the biggest reason the state secrets privilege was involved in my case.
Absolutely. Well, not only what you've spoken of today, but also in the article, which again, I would suggest people go and read for themselves, contains so many of the different dots connecting U.S. NATO interests to Turkey and to the indirectly then to the Chechen rebels and even directly. And for example, you mentioned the heavy political heavy hitters involved with the American-Turkish Council. Well, there's also the American Committee for Peace in Chechnya, an organization which I'm sure many of the listeners have never heard of before, but it includes Richard Perle and Elliot Abrams and James Woolsey and Michael Ledeen and many of the signatories to the now infamous Project for a New American Century. So there are so many dots connecting these entities. So I guess the obvious question is, why is there such intense American interest in this region? And what is really the end game of funding and fomenting these Islamic radicals in the Central Asian Caucasus?
As they have been and they had been in the past, they have these groups, whether it's the Chechens or the other, you know, terrorist or extremist groups, they are being used as pawns against who we consider to be our enemies. I mean, our competitors in that region happens to be our two top competitors, Russia and China. And we use these groups against Russia and China. If you start looking at the incidents, for example, of some of these Central Asian countries and Caucasus that are involved in the pipeline project, and you look at the timing of when certain pipeline gets to be blown up by either a Chechen group or by some mysterious Islamist extremist groups, take a note and then go and take a look at and see who did they make that country that was the target of this attack, their pipelines, who did they make any kind of agreements with? You will see that usually those days coincides with some agreement being signed by China, you know, and between China and that particular country, or it's another agreement is between Russia and that particular country, or maybe that country is saying, well, we are getting too much opposition, we don't want your base here. Yeah, you kick us out of here, you're going to have so many terrorist incidents. When we have base, we also would protect you, the government. Otherwise, the terrorists, the extremists, they're going to take over, you know, your government, because nobody's going to be there to protect you. So it's both blackmail, but also carrying out these operations. And what happens is that region, for example, that is getting too close to China or Russia, suddenly, especially with U.S. mainstream media, gets the global attention of being an unsafe country. It's not a stable country. You know, you start seeing NGOs leaving that country, U.S.-related NGOs, or getting kicked out of those countries. And the foreign investors from Europe, they start taking away their investments. So there are various ways that we blackmail these nations. You got to side with us. We want Chevron to have it. You make a deal with China, okay, you're going to have terrorist incidents. With our media, we're going to make sure these foreign investors from the West, they're going to start taking back their stuff. So you're going to be suffering financially. And you take the base away, you know, you are going to be hit by terrorists and you're going to be taken over. This is how we operate. This is called our foreign policy. This has been our foreign policy for now more than half a century. We did that with Middle East, and this is the new Middle East. And people don't realize, you know, so much emphasis is on Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Iran. This region, the Central Asia Caucasus region, has been brewing for almost two decades. And when things start blowing up there, most Americans, if not, I would say 90%, 99%, they're going to say, hey, where did that come from? They're going to think it just came, boom, all of a sudden, out of the blue. And meanwhile, for years, I have been saying, maybe some good authors, analysts, they've been talking, look at this region. It's being set up, and this is the new Middle East. All the bloodbaths, all the regional wars, all the ethnic wars, all the religion, Islam-related being used wars are going to be happening there. Nobody's going to be paying attention to Saudi Arabia. It's going to be that region.
So essentially, the globe is the chessboard, and the Central Asia Caucasus region is the juicy area in the middle of that chessboard with all of the resource wealth there, and the Islamic terrorists who are funded by the U.S. and manipulated by the CIA and based in Turkey for the most part are the pawns on the board that are being used to try to take away those strategic assets from the other team, the China and Russia.
Absolutely. And this is exactly what bin Laden and his group, now is being called Al-Qaeda, did for the United States all the way. And as I'm saying, I have been saying all the way until the end of 2001, they did operate with us in Central Asia, Caucasus, and in the Balkans. What happened was after Afghanistan, they were the same ones we used against the same enemy, Russia. And this is after the Cold War, in their turn. Over there in Central Asia. And I mean, let's say they killed, we don't know how exactly he died, bin Laden. Who would have wanted this guy arrested and brought to trial? You know how much this guy can talk about? And if someone were to ask me to just predict, again, this is not scientific, they would say, where do you think Ayman Zawahiri is today? I would put my finger down and I would tell you, Ayman Zawahiri is in that region, and that would be around Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, in the border with Afghanistan, because that's where we are carrying out a lot of these operations. And especially in the past 10 years, it has moved towards that region. And I would put my finger in that on that region on the map, and I would say, this is where most likely, based on how we did things that I got to find out, he's there, because that's where we are using religion. We love Islamic extremism. Without that, our foreign policy would have to just turn upside down, because that is our foreign policy for that region.
extremely fascinating and an extremely important topic that even the alternative media, for the most part, is neglecting. So it is really too much information to take in any one conversation. So for people who are interested in finding out more about the backstory and the history and the documented examples of everything we've been talking about today, what resources would you recommend for them?
So much is out there within the European mainstream media in terms of if you want to make a nice timeline of the terrorism incidents and the infighting and the competition. We have some good authors here. I mean, Global Research Canada, Center for Globalization in Canada, they have excellent collections of essays and analysis that they publish on this region. I mean, we have, of course, William Engdahl. He is one of the best out there who has been focusing on this region. You also would want to look at, I mean, if you go and even use, let's say, any kind of a search engine, and you start putting the keywords in there with these nations, and this is interesting because most American journalists, they call themselves journalists, they don't even know where these nations are. I mean, you start talking with them, it's like, I don't want to deal with a country that I can't even spell, Azerbaijan, Kyrgyzstan. It's just been, you know, how many, you know, correspondents do we have in that region? None. So if you start putting even the keyword, you start getting some resources. I would tell them, if you come across the NGOs in the United States that are publishing, read it, but realize who is funding them and whose side they are in. Because you can get some good information about the general issues about those regions, especially with their resources. But when it comes to interpretation of those facts, you know, in terms of, okay, yeah, well, this group did this and this and this, but not as to how or why. For just general information, look at those. You know, you will come to various EurasiaNet and publications. So it gives you a good broad knowledge. But again, get your own data. Think about it, you know, critical thinking. And start putting the pieces together. It's not difficult. As I said, this headlines came out with these assassinations. I mean, this is a juicy story, isn't it? You would think the U.S. mainstream media would be all over this. I mean, this is our James Bond-like kind of an incidents here, the chain of incidents. Then you have these issues. Hollywood should go offer them the life, right? You know, they go to Turkey, and you're looking at one or two operatives. And within a couple of months, they just, bam, bam, they start assassinating these people, getting out. How did they get in? Forged passports. You know, under false identities, identification, incredibly juicy story. They don't. And that's one way for people to understand how important it is, because when you look at all this and say, how could the U.S. media so consistently for nearly two decades not report on these issues? Not 1 year or 2 years, for almost two decades. And the reason is, nobody wants within the government for these issues to be reported. Susurluk incident that we talked about, when it took place, it was the headline, front page news in France, in Germany, in the United Kingdom. Just for people, just search Susurluk in English, and you will see that for months. I mean, you had these trials. You had the prime minister involved in this. And do you know the main actor in Susurluk incident and the accident, if people get to read about it, the main actor, Çatlı, do you know where he was up until 5 or 6 days before Susurluk? He was most wanted by the Interpol in 1988. He somehow escapes this high security jail in Switzerland, and he escapes it with a helicopter. Okay, this is 1988, somehow. And you would see it. You would see Independent, you know, UK, the newspapers about the incident. Nobody knows how, but he escaped from this high security facility with a helicopter. And nobody knows how, but he ended up in Britain. And again, people are confused, but he actually was granted citizenship in England while he was Interpol's most wanted guy, most wanted. And 2 years later, in 1991, somehow he came to the United States. He went to Chicago, and mysteriously he got a green card. And his base was set up in Chicago until a week before Susurluk incident. In 1995, 1996, there was an assassination attempt on Aliyev in Azerbaijan. And their investigation showed, Russian investigation, Azerbaijan, and later everybody accepted it, that the guy who carried it out was Abdullah Çatlı. Now, he went to Azerbaijan, taking off from Chicago, going to Turkey, and then from Turkey to Azerbaijan. The guy, he's most wanted by Interpol, and he's given citizenship, and he operates his base here. Another region that the mainstream media either does not report on, or when they do, is a very sympathetic, and I'm not saying that there shouldn't be any sympathy, but is this what they refer to as Uyghuristan, East Turkestan in China. Again, we are using the same Islamic elements. We have been using Turkey, and this is since 1996 in that region. All the uprisings there in Xinjiang province there, they are all coordinated by U.S. and Turkish arm of NATO. And again, this person from Susurluk that was killed in that accident, the main guy in Susurluk incident who lived in Chicago and was given citizenship, he made 8 trips from Chicago to Beijing, China. And from there, he would take off and he would go to that region 8 times, but not from Turkey. He was heading there from Chicago. These are documented. And a lot of times people, they say, why don't you spill the beans? And I just look and say, you have no idea how much I have been talking. It's not going to really matter if I were to talk about some specific wiretap, that specific target and phone number. That's not going to add anything. I have been talking about the content of what has been labeled as the highest level classified state secrets privilege. But there is this attitude out there by so many people saying, she should just come out and spill the beans. And I'm spilling the beans right now here, James, in your show. And I'm giving you a lot of state secrets privilege here that that people have been hearing. But either they think it's not juicy enough, or because of the lack of education here, the lack of mainstream media, they don't seem to have a grasp of the importance, significance of this.
Well, I think that hits the issue on the head right there. So few people are really informed about these issues generally that unfortunately they don't have really a context to situate this information in. So I hope that's something that we can continue doing, as people might notice that we're concentrating more on the Central Asian region with our eye-opener reports. So I certainly hope people will continue to stay tuned to those for more information and some of the context of what's happening here. And you bring up, of course, the issue of terrorists being basically concealed and ensconced in the UK and in the US. And there were a number of incidents of high-profile terrorists getting free passes into the UK and into the US. So I think people need to look at the history of that. And as you point out, the fascinating story of Russian assassinations taking place in Turkey, of course, has all the makings of an incredible mainstream media-type news story, but the media silence on that issue is particularly telling, especially when contrasted with the hyperventilation we saw over the Saudi Arabian ambassador assassination plot by the Iranians, or that whole made-up story. So the contrast there, I think, is speaking for itself. But as I say, just a fascinating story and so many aspects of it that we can't really do it all justice in one conversation. But I certainly will put in the plug that you did not put in for people to go to boilingfrogspost.com, which obviously has accrued many articles now over the years on this topic and about some of these figures that we've been talking about today. But I'm afraid I think we'll have to leave it there. So, Sibel Edmonds, an absolutely fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, James.